Stranger, henceforth be warned, and know that pride, howe'er disguised in its own majesty, is littleness. That he who feels contempt for any living thing hath faculties which he has never used. Welcome to another episode of the Troubadour Podcast, and this is Sunday Morning Poetry. Today, we're going to go over the poem, the complicated, haunting, interesting, mysterious, frustrating poem, Lines, left upon a seat in a yew tree, which stands near the Lake of Esthwaite. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct. Which stands near the Lake of Esthwaite on a desolate part of the shore, yet commanding a beautiful prospect. That's the title. There are many lines poem. This is by William Wordsworth in his poem or in his book with Coleridge, Lyrical Ballads, that we've been going over. There are poems, lines written above Tintern Abbey is the most famous of them. But these are lines poem. These are like little epitaphs, little moments that he captures, and he's trying to capture something, and so he writes lines about them. Now remember, poetry is not something for Wordsworth that is just a random thing. This is something that is an overflowing of passion recollected in tranquility. So there are numerous versions that he put out, two main versions he put out of this exact poem, where he made major or he made slight and sometimes major edits. And he tinkered with his work a lot because he recollected in tranquility, meaning he meditated, he had a powerful overflow of certain emotions, and then the writing was the tranquility part. That's when he would reflect on it and think heavily on what he wanted to say. In this, he is 28 years old, and this, I believe, begins the dominant project of his life. And let me read a little quote from his biography. This is after writing lines left upon a seat in a yew tree. William himself now chose to look outward to the unsung individuals who formed the mass of humanity, and he appointed himself their champion. His theme, he declared, would be no other than the very heart of man. It was a bold decision, and one which would bring ridicule upon him from those, the vast majority of the reading public, who believed that peddlers and wagoners were not fit subjects for poetry. So at the somewhat late age of almost 28, William had at last found his vocation in life. Now, why is this relevant? The poem Lines Left Upon a Seat in a Yew Tree is about an actual man that Wordsworth knew of. It's about an actual place, although, as he notes later in life, regrettably, the tree and much of the area has been cut down, and a pleasure house, or probably he means a whorehouse, has been put up in its stead. But the individual, this I'm quoting Wordsworth in his notes later, the individual whose habits and character are here given was a gentleman of the neighborhood, a man of talent and learning, who had been educated at one of our universities, and returned to pass his time in seclusion on his own estate. He died a bachelor in middle age. Induced by the beauty of the prospect, he built a small summer house on the rocks above the peninsula on which the ferry house ground stands. So what is going on in the poem, Lines Left Upon a Seat in a Yew Tree, is, I think, to the best of my ability, like I said, is a very mysterious, foreboding, haunting tale that I think has various interpretations, and there are no solid, this is what it means. And I think part of the reason is, at this stage of the game, Wordsworth is unsure himself. And so, especially in the 1798 version, in 1802, I think he becomes a little bit more clear. He adds several lines. He changes words like genius to science, and we start getting what he's trying to accomplish of creating a new religion. That's one of his kind of views of what he wants to do, is he believes that the Orthodox religion that he grew up in and that everybody in Europe and England especially grew up in at that time was corrupt, and it led to corruption, and that to get to the soul and the heart of man, you had to go into actual living individuals. Now, Wordsworth decided to, he chose to spend much of his time on the normal people around him, the peasant people. But peasant people going through a particular situation, like a mad mother or a female vagrant or a Cumberland beggar, or a man who was neglected, a genius who was neglected and never found success in life, died of middle age, and the cause is something that Wordsworth warns us against at the end. He believes it's a certain kind of pride, and it's a pride that is excessively believing in your own greatness, I think is one way of looking at it, to the extent that you can push aside all of humanity and focus only on your own greatness, your own inner genius, and you know, lament that other people don't see and understand how great and genius you are. And I think anybody would agree that that is a problem. And so this man has that problem. Now, the other part of this poem is the view we start to get, and we've got this before, and we're getting this all over the lyrical ballads, especially the 1802 version. And then, you know, this goes on with other longer poems that he does, like the Ruined Cottage, which, you know, he is published separately, The Recluse, which he doesn't complete, and of course The Prelude. But we can talk about how that all fits together as we go in these explorations of Wordsworth. But what he's doing now in this poem is he's setting forth some of his views on this idea of a new religion and education coming from a contemplation of nature. Now, what he realizes, I think, later, this is a hypothesis of mine as I'm studying this, I believe what he begins to realize is that it's not, you can't be just a normal person just looking out at the leaves and the streams and the moon, and then boom, you're going to be educated. It has to be through the kind of poetry and philosophy and words that is done by a great man, written by a great man. And I think that's what he starts to see, is the role of poetry in his own work. And he does, like many great poets, has a kind of meta poem about, you know, the power of this stuff, the power of philosophy, the power of poetry. And this is a philosophical poem for sure. I mean, he's talking about there's a man he's very influenced by, and he's criticizing his form of egotism in here. So it's an egotism that is a very specific one he's talking about. He's also, you know, there's a particular view of benevolence that a man by God, name of Godwin, at this time, he's writing around the French Revolution, was pen pals, and they knew each other, and you know, Wordsworth and Godwin, and they're kind of going back and forth, and Godwin heavily influenced Wordsworth and his view of the French Revolution, and his view of that this is a good thing what they're doing, and it's going to lead to only great things, and benevolence will take over, and then of course Wordsworth becomes a little disillusioned by this when he starts to see the terror, the murder, the destruction, the mayhem that occurs. But in this poem, we're getting the first inklings of this, and we're getting the inkling of, okay, so here we are out in nature in Lakewood. Let me show you a little painting, actually. So this is a painting of the Lake District, the famous Lake District in England, that, and in this area, Wordsworth eventually would live and die. He would live most of his life, or the majority of his life, in Lake District. Now, so imagine a scenario like this, although even more lush, maybe, you know, and there's of course not in this, you know, right in the foreground of this, there's not a big yew tree, but imagine a large yew tree overlooking all of this. And in that yew tree, Y-E-W, is a seat, a man put together stones so you could sit there. And upon that seat are lines. Now the lines, you know, this is, it's not clear. Are the lines written in the stone? Is it just a handwritten letter? Is it written in chalk? We don't know. But we know that lines left upon a yew seat, upon a seat in a yew tree, the yew tree which stands near the lake of Esthwaite, on a desolate part of the shore. So this is a little bit desolate part of the shore, yet commanding a beautiful prospect. So still being able to see, that's the title of this poem. Okay, I'm going to read the poem, then we're going to break it down as much as I can. And, you know, if anybody's interested, maybe we'll do another discussion on the 1802 version. But only if people are interested. Otherwise, I'll put it in. If you go to troubadourmag.com, I will put the 1798 version, a couple of notes with some definitions that I looked up. I mean, I always recommend looking up a couple of definitions, even if you think you know what it means. Like impulse is used, for instance, and you know he's using this in, I think, a more scientific way. But there is a question that these individuals at this time are asking themselves about what does drive man? And that's kind of what impulse is used. What is man's impulse? So it's an important one to look up. What, you know, it comes from the Latin for driven on. What drives you to drive something, right? In physics, it's like an impulse could be a force that's forced onto something. And it's a Newtonian, it's a term used by Newton often. So, and there's a couple other ones, but for the most part, Wordsworth is good about not using too many words that you don't know. Okay, so let's go ahead and check this out. I'm going to pop this on screen so you guys can see it. Okay, so if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, I'm also going to be showing the words, which sometimes help to read out loud along with me, or maybe not out loud along with me, but at least read along with me. And if not, I, you know, will read slowly. You could always listen to this twice, the reading of it itself. Okay, so lions left upon a seat in a yew tree, which stands near the lake of Esthwaite on a desolate part of the shore, yet commanding a beautiful prospect. Nay, traveler, rest. This lonely yew tree stands far from all human dwelling. What if here no sparkling rivulet spread the verdant herb? What if these barren boughs the bee not loves? Yet, if the wind breathes soft, the curling waves that break against the shore shall lull thy mind by one soft impulse saved from vacancy. Who he was that piled these stones, and with the mossy sod first covered o'er, and taught this aged tree, now wild, to bend its arms in circling shade, I well remember. He was one who owned no common soul. In youth, by genius nursed and big with lofty views, he to the world went forth pure in his heart against the taint of dissolute tongues, against jealousy and hate and scorn, against all enemies prepared, all but neglect. And so his spirit damped at once. With rash disdain he turned away, and with the food of pride sustained his soul in solitude. Stranger, these gloomy boughs had charms for him, and here he loved to sit. His only visitants, a straggling sheep, the stone chat, or the glancing sandpiper. And on these barren rocks, with juniper, and heath, and thistle, thinly sprinkled o'er, fixing his downward eye, he many an hour a morbid pleasure nourished, tracing here an emblem of his own unfruitful life. And lifting up his head, he then would gaze on the more distant scene. How lovely 'tis thou seest! And he would gaze till it became far lovelier, and his heart could not sustain the beauty still more beauteous. Nor that time would he forget those beings, to whose minds warm from the labors of benevolence, the world, and man himself, appeared a scene of kindred loveliness, and he would sigh with mournful joy to think that others felt what he must never feel. And so lost man on visionary views would fancy feed, till his eyes streamed with tears. In this deep vale he died, this seat his only monument. If thou be one whose heart the holy forms of younger imagination have kept pure, stranger, henceforth be warned, and know that pride, however disguised in its own majesty, is littleness. That he who feels contempt for any living thing hath faculties which he has never used. That thought with him is in its infancy. The man whose eye is ever on himself doth look on one the least of nature's works, one who might move the wise man to that scorn which wisdom holds unlawful ever. Oh, be wiser thou, instructed that true knowledge leads to love, true dignity abides with him alone, who, in the silent hour of inward thought, can still suspect and still revere himself in lowliness of heart. That last one's lowliness, not loneliness. Just in case you got confused there because of my mispronunciation. Okay, so, well, if that made any sense to you, as I say, you're a genius because I've read it dozens of times. I'm still trying to figure some of this stuff out. So just as a quick, you know, to get started though, this beginning confusing thing, this beginning stanza is somewhat confusing. Although if you take a step back and try and not just, I have to understand what each and every word combination and phrase means, what you do get in this isolated phrase or this isolated, stanza is an admonition, you know, a statement to a traveler. Remember, these are a traveler's reading this, you have to assume, on a yew tree stone stand, a seat. And it says on this thing, so you're walking, let's imagine for a moment this is actually literally true. You're imagining, you're walking to this beautiful lake, you know, it's gorgeous all around, you're maybe by yourself, maybe you're walking, doing a walking tour in Europe, and you see this. And it says, nay, traveler, rest. It's like, okay, well, a seat is meant to be rested on. Okay. This lonely yew tree stands far from all human dwelling. And you look around, and of course, there's no other human dwellings. And it's like, okay, I get it. So it's by itself. You're separated from, you know, humanity. And there's something important about solitude. If you listen to my Sunday morning poetry a couple of weeks ago, I did the poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by Wordsworth, and compared it to John Keats's poem, O Solitude. And, you know, solitude is important in life. I think it's something we neglect, and especially in our busy world, we should think about it more. And so we're far from human dwelling. What if here no sparkling rivulet spread the verdant herb? So I think it's interesting, like, what if here no sparkling rivulet? So it's almost like my instinct is saying that it's almost as though he's trying to, in a sense, separate you even farther from all of existence, all living creatures and things. What if here no sparkling rivulet, a stream, spread the verdant herb? So what if you're in a different place? What if these barren boughs the bee not loves? So what if there are no bees and there's no, you know, nature growth any kind of sentient beings? Yet, if the wind breathes soft, the curling waves that break against the shore shall lull thy mind by one soft impulse saved from vacancy. So this is very much like a meditation practice is what I'm taking from this. And, you know, he's not a Buddhist. I don't know how familiar he is with Buddhism, but there is something about this that is very much saying, hey, you know, if you've ever just gone on a rock, and I was actually on a rock the other day, overlooking the ocean, and you know, just by myself. I was on the Highway 1 in California. So it's this highway that just goes all along the California coast. I was on my motorcycle and I stopped and there was no one around. And I just, you know, I was on this hill, this big old rock overlooking the ocean. You could just hear the ocean kind of crashing. And there is a kind of lulling of the mind. This is why oceans are really nice to be around, is it kind of is calming and it's rhythmic and it never stops. And just, it can lull, L-U-L-L-Y, your mind. By one soft impulse saved from vacancy. So your mind's not vacant, but it's, you know, it's in that moment right before it, is what I'm taking from that. But my point is that this first stanza, even though it's somewhat confusing, at least for me, in terms of what he means by what if here no spark, you know, what if there is no sparkling rivulet here? What if these barren boughs, the tree limbs, the bee doesn't love? Okay, I mean, what if, I don't know. I don't know what he's trying to say with that. But what you do get is you get a view of bees, you know, that's the positive. You get boughs, even though they're barren boughs, you get streams and verdant herbs. And then of course the wind breathing softly, the curling waves. These are all sensual things we're getting. These are all perceptual awarenesses. We're seeing things. So he's painting a picture. This is where the yew tree stands. Now, the question is, who made this seat? And here we're getting an answer. Who he was that piled these stones and with the mossy sod first covered o'er and taught this aged tree, now wild, to bend its arms in circling shade, I well remember. So we get that a person put these stones together. It's not done by nature. I mean, so if you walk up to this yew tree, you can see, oh, this is man-made structure within this tree. And it's really, you know, a nice touch that he says, and taught this aged tree. You know, it's like he's the tutor instructing it, but it's kind of, this is gardening. This is landscaping. He's bending the tree to his will. So he's making the tree turn it, do what he wants it, the man, you know, and this is part of the power of man in nature. And it's, there is a symbiosis here going on of nature and bending nature to your will. And that's what this man has done, is he hasn't killed it and destroyed it for the sake of killing it. He's taught it. And of course, Wordsworth says, I well remember who this was. Who is he? He was one who owned no common soul. So he's an uncommon person. In youth, by genius nursed and big with lofty views, he to the world went forth pure in his heart against the taint of dissolute tongues, against jealousy and hate and scorn, against all enemies prepared, all but neglect. So who is this man? He has no uncommon soul. He's a genius. And when he was young, he was nursed by genius. Now, genius is a term that originally meant something like a house spirit, but this house spirit could be, you know, I think I don't know the full story of the etymology, but I know enough that it, you know, I think in Latin times or in Roman times, it was this spirit of the house. And then later on, it took on the meaning of, you know, intelligence and extra intelligence. And by the way, in this particular version, or and then the another version he did in 1802, when he did some edits, he said of this, instead of genius nursed, he was one who owned no common soul, in youth by science nursed and led by nature into a wild scene. So he changed it to science instead of genius, which I think is more specific and more indicative of his own philosophy at this time. And that science was a very positive thing, as you know, as he understood it. And it is a positive thing, of course, but that this person is, through a certain kind of knowledge, is nursed, and he's a genius. And then, of course, he's big with lofty views. He has a large vision for his future and for the world and for humanity. And he to the world went forth pure in his heart. So he goes forth with this view, and he's pure and he's strong and he's ready to take on the world. And he's ready to take on the taint of dissolute tongues, you know, men who and women who talk with forked tongues and talk in you know, with lies and cheats and trying to finagle him out of his views and his genius. And he goes up against jealousy, and he goes up against hate, and he goes up against scorn, against all enemies he's prepared. There's one enemy he's not prepared for: neglect. And this, I think, is a very striking thing. If we're all being honest with ourselves, that most of us, I will just put in myself included, if you're trying to put forth something into the world, you're, you know, trying to create something, you're trying to build something, you want to do something unique, this is something you have to go through 100%. The jealousy, the hate, the scorn, all these enemies, dissolute tongues. But the one that is very difficult to go up against is neglect. Neglect is a difficult one because it's, you know, like I always tell people when I talk, you know, if anybody asks me, which happens on a rare occasion, what, you know, as being in sales and marketing and trying to get my own creative work into the hands of people, the, what it feels like to have, you know, to deal with no's, like N-O. So I, you know, being in sales, I got a lot of no's in my life. A lot of people said no to me. A lot of people still say no to me all the time. And, you know, I always tell them that a no is actually such an amazing thing. I love a no, because you can work with a no. If you're in sales, your job essentially is to take someone from a no to a yes. Then, you know, I always say that the no is never the end. It's always the beginning. But what is the end is silence, neglect, ignorance, ghosting. That is impossible or almost impossible to beat around. If someone won't look at you, talk to you, acknowledge you, answer your email, answer your phone calls, you know, acknowledge your existence, that is impossible. You can't start from anywhere. There's nothing there. So neglect is one of the worst things you can have, you know, the worst enemies. And it's such a difficult thing to deal with is neglect. And I think today it's a lot easier to neglect people. I mean, they even have, you know, I did some canvassing in my early sales, although most of it wasn't canvassing, but occasionally I would do some canvassing. That's knocking on doors, trying to sell stuff. And, you know, people didn't know who you were as much. Now there's these, you know, I don't do this now, but I would imagine, you know, more people are getting those little, what are they called? Like just little cameras that you can put on your door to see who it is. And you can answer it from wherever you want. And you can say, you know, who is it, you know, from your cell phone? And they're like, you know, I'm Kirk with, Cutco. And like, yeah, sorry, I'm in Spain or something. Like they could pretend like they're anywhere. It's like, yeah, but I see your light on and I saw, you know, shadow going on. Nope. You know? And so neglect, the point is neglect is really, really challenging. And this individual who built this yew tree in this poem, watch what happens to him. So he was neglected. He was prepared for all enemies, but neglect. And so his spirit damped at once. With rash disdain, he turned away. And with the food of pride, sustained his soul in solitude. So what is he doing? So he got neglected. His spirit dampened. He became disdained with everybody. He's like, you don't know. I'm a genius. I'm great. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're missing out on. So he feeds his soul on pride. That is the pride of this inner thing, this inner genius that he has. And he goes away from humanity. Stranger, these gloomy boughs had charms for him. So now the poet or the lines is talking to whoever's reading. So there are multiple characters in this story. I'm not going to go through all of them. You're one of them. The writer of the, you know, Wordsworth, I think, is one of them because it's actually from him. But then there's also this idea that the yew tree, the stone, or the seat, is also with these lines written upon it. That's also saying something to whoever happens to pass by. So stranger, these gloomy boughs had charms for him. Here he loved to sit. His only visitants, a straggling sheep, the stone chat, that's just a bird, or the glancing sandpiper, another bird. and look them up if you want some pictures. I didn't get them on here. And on these barren rocks with juniper and heath and thistle, these are just bushes and flowers, thinly sprinkled over, fixing his downward eye. So he's dejected, right? He's fixing his downward eye. He many an hour a morbid pleasure nourished. Many an hour a morbid pleasure nourished. If you ever wondered how individuals, you know, who get to a certain age get so upset, morose, disdainful, angry, furious at the world. He's showing you the inner workings of that individual. He's tracing the inner existence of this individual in just a few lines. There's a movie, As Good As It Gets, with Jack Nicholson, where you see this individual and you can get a sense of that character, the writer who has, I mean, that character could, this poem could be written somewhat about Jack Nicholson's character in that. And he receives pleasure in his morbid thoughts. He nourishes himself, and he's a writer sitting in his, in his hermitage, in his nice, fancy New York walk up or whatever it is, New York apartment. I think he's in New York. And he's, a huge best-selling author. He believes he's this, genius at the times, and everyone's an idiot. And, he many an hour a morbid pleasure nourished. So he nourishes this morbid pleasure in his solitude and how he's better than the other people who don't recognize or truly understand him. Tracing here an emblem of his own unfruitful life. So this is one difference between As Good As It Gets guy and this guy, and this character who created this seat, is this seat designer or builder had an unfruitful life. Nothing came of his life. He had no kids, no great works of art. So the character As Good As It Gets at least has best-selling books, like really best-selling books, and they're well-loved by people, apparently. Okay, continuing on. And lifting up his head, he then would gaze on the more distant scene. So his head is down. He's dejected. He's enjoying this morbid pleasure, nourishing himself on it. And then he looks up, would gaze on the distant scene. How lovely 'tis thou seest. And he would gaze till it became far lovelier. And his heart could not sustain the beauty still more beauteous. So he looks up at nature and he sees something that the rest of us don't see, are unable to see, or incapable of to see, are too busy to see. And it does something to his soul. Right? He become far lovelier, and his heart could not sustain it. Nor that time would he forget those beings to whose minds, warm from the labors of benevolence, the world and man himself appeared a scene of kindred loveliness. So he's contemplating the relationship between the whole of humanity, the labors of, warm from the labors of benevolence, the world and man himself appeared a scene of kindred. Then he would sigh with mournful joy. It's one of the great oxymorons, right? Mournful joy. Did I say that right? Mournful joy. Oxymoron. To think that others felt what he must never feel. So now we're getting a look at the bitterness, and this is the view. So there's a view of, I think, a kind of critique here of Godwin, like I said, and one of the famous, or I guess the only famous example or analogy, I don't know what they call it, like philosophical story. I don't know what to call it. I'm not a philosopher, obviously, but it's a story about that sums up, or that Godwin uses as example of the kind of benevolence that we should strive for, and that is the ideal for humanity. And that is, he gave an example, I don't remember the Pope or the Archbishop, or it was some really famous Archbishop who was writing a pamphlet that benefited all of humanity. It came forth with some new idea. I think it's like Fenelon or something, Archbishop Fenelon and your mother. And those two are in a fire, in a house in a fire, and you can only save one. Who should you save? Your mother or the Archbishop who's about to create this new, society-changing treatise? And if you want to put it in context today, just imagine it's somebody who's writing, let's make it really simple. Like who's writing out their research on how to cure cancer, but they're not finished. So which one should you save? Should you save the Archbishop or your mother or the cancer scientist or your mother? Which one should you save? Now he says you should save the Archbishop. You know, you should do the greatest thing. I mean, he was later, I think, a someone who the utilitarians would, quote sometimes. And that, I think, is, you know, so this kind of nor that time would he forget those beings to whose minds, warm from the labors of benevolence, the world and man himself appeared a scene of kindred loveliness. And he's about to critique this whole thing, or he's critiquing it a little bit here. Because he's saying this man who built this seat is looking out at nature. You know, he's isolated. He's given up. He's become a hermit. He's given up on mankind. And he's contemplating all these human minds out there and their quote unquote labors of benevolence. And then he would sigh with mournful joy. And again, think about what it means to mournful, you know, is feeling, we can think of it as grief or regret. I think sadness, you know, but it's usually not a happy thing. So you don't put joy and mournful with mournful joy, but it's kind of like a regretful joy or a grief stricken joy. And it's something like the morbid pleasure. So you're getting these kind of oxymorons that go together that are not, you know, kind of go together in a weird way here. And when you try to parse them out, you get this image of a man who's taking pleasure in the pain that he has, that he feels, and in the pain that, you know, what the rest of the world is like. And what is this mournful, with mournful joy? What is the mournful joy of? To think that others felt what he must never feel. So he's getting almost the pleasure, joy from the fact that they're getting something out of life that he's not getting. And so lost man on visionary views would fancy feed till his eyes streamed with tears. In this deep vale he died, this seat his only monument. Now, the only thing I can come up with, and this is extremely hard, I don't know if I'm right about this, but it, you know, when he talks about this seat his only monument, is we have a man here who's contemplating nature and mankind, right? He's thinking on kindred loveliness. He's thinking on the world, the people with, you know, whose minds are warm from labors, you know, from labors of benevolence, right? And I think that's said somewhat caustically. I don't think he means that. And he would sigh and he would think, you know, and I think a part of it is he's almost like a priest that never was, like a priest of a new religion that never was, that was never taken seriously, that was neglected, that was pushed aside. And we can't imagine, I mean, if we take something like you know, there is a secular religion. I mean, take, you know, if you have a favorite thinker or a favorite person, and what if that person never was recognized at all? They were just completely neglected. I mean, if you like Ayn Rand, just imagine if Ayn Rand never got The Fountainhead published, ever. And she never got Anthem published, even. Like, she wrote those things, and they're just sitting on her shelf, and nobody ever read them. Right? And she was this genius that, you know, she never met Peikoff. They never launched a movement together in objectivist thinking. And none of that happened. None of it. There's no romantic manifesto. None of it. What would have happened to her? What would her soul be like? Would she have grown bitter? And reading interviews, and I remember listening to, maybe it was in her journals, or I don't remember where it was, but, you know, she mentioned that before she finally got The Fountainhead finished or published, there were times of somewhat morbid pleasure or morbid thoughts, maybe not morbid pleasure. But you can imagine how this might turn out for her if she hadn't gotten those things done, which is not impossible. I mean, I know we always think that we give all the credit to geniuses that they deserve, but I don't think that's always the truth or the case. And this is what happens to them. And in this deep vale, he died, this seat his only monument. But there's something else wrong with this individual, we'll find out. So now we get the admonition to you, the warning to you, dear reader. If you be one whose heart the holy forms of younger imagination have kept pure, stranger, henceforth be warned. So for him and Coleridge, the imagination is the thing that puts together the perceptual awarenesses that we see in whatever ways that we want to by our free will and reason. It's a very important term, imagination, and especially the romantics. Imagination is one of the key terms in romantic thinking. And I think it is a key term that we should be more mindful of. And imagination is not simply thinking up random games to play. I mean, there's imagination is putting an image in your mind, a new image. Like, you know, the simple example is, I'm an atheist, so all the images you get in religion are just the uses of the imagination. There's no such thing of a heaven with clouds and there's a man and there's a pearly gates, but we have all those elements in the world around us separated from that total picture. So of course we know what a man looks like. We know what a gate looks like. We know what clouds look like. So the imagination puts those all together and then says that's the pearly gates into heaven and that's heaven. Right? But that's ridiculous. Obviously that's just someone made that shit up. That's imagination. And you could do a lot with imagination. You can create new religions. Maybe we can create a secular religion. Maybe we could create a religion without a divine entity telling us what to do, but that is out in nature. And, you know, the generic term for this is pantheism, which is nature is God, God is nature. But Wordsworth, I think, struggles with this because he doesn't exactly mean an all-powerful, omniscient, omnipotent, God of nature. He means that there's a symbiosis in educating yourself through looking out at the world and coming up with ideas and coming up with imagining your own thoughts on something. And he'll say that here at the end. And henceforth be warned and know that pride, however disguised in its own majesty, is littleness. So nourishing yourself on pride is not a good thing. And so he's accepting at this point in his career the idea of, just the generic Catholic Church view of pride. Now, by the way, he's going to change this a bit. In the prelude, the theme of the prelude is essentially the growth of the poet's, of his mind as a poet, the growth of the poet's mind. And, you know, he wrote exclusively about his own mind and he takes pride in his own mind. So he's not against pride, but he's not for or against it. He's struggling with understanding it. Remember, this is 1790. I think he wrote this in like 96. He's 28 years old. He's struggling. This is way before we really understand reason. And I think even then they didn't really understand how reason worked. They didn't have the right methods. I think they made mistakes. And this is, you know, his struggle is part of it. That he who feels contempt for any living thing has faculties which he has never used. I assume he means something like, if you feel contempt for the little man, you're missing out on something and you don't have a certain faculty, you know, maybe empathy. That thought with him is in its infancy. So if you don't have these faculties to look out and to think about the things around you, and I don't think he just means, you know, like this seat designer builder guy or bums. I think he means a whole bunch of different sentient beings. You need to think about them. If you don't, then that thought with him is in its infancy. The man whose eye, is ever on himself doth look on one the least of nature's works. So he's attacking you. He's saying, if your eye is only on yourself and you never look outward. And this, I think, is an example of him attacking a kind of Cartesian reasoning, rationality. And I agree with him in this. I see this all the time where people are, you know, if you ever talk to a libertarian, their thought is only on themselves or their own thoughts. And they're just kind of churning around in their own thoughts. They never look at new things. And this is one of the key, I think one of the things are the major components of our own era. Maybe it's true of every era. Maybe it's just humanity. But we see this all the time where people just kind of, you know, we call it, they get in their echo chambers. They hear a couple thoughts from other people. Their eye goes in on themselves and on people like them. And they never look outward at new facts, new ways of looking at things. They never challenge everything. I mean, anything that they believe. They don't consciously challenge something. So if you're an objectivist and I talked about pride and you got all like squirmy, there's something wrong with you. You need to be able to challenge your own conception of pride. When is pride not good? In what conception is pride not a good thing? And there are conceptions where it's not good. Ayn Rand defined it a very particular way to make it good. And I agreed with what she says. But if you mean it in the sense of being fully obsessed with anything you do and not thinking about, you know, what it will mean for you long term or what it will mean for, you know, your existence on this planet and traversing it properly, that's a problem. The man whose eye is ever on himself does look on one the least of nature's works, one who might move the wiser man to that scorn which wisdom holds unlawful ever. I don't know what that means. That last part, I just don't know. One who, if you know what it means, hit me up. One who might move the wise man, the man who loves wisdom. Maybe it's the man who's already there or who's gone to another level or another stage of thoughtfulness, full of thought, which wisdom holds unlawful. So it's possible that he's talking about, because if you take this sentence as a whole, the man whose eye is ever on himself doth look on one, the least of nature's work. So you're the least of nature's work if you look at yourself. Now, a better person, one who might move the wise man to that scorn, which wisdom holds unlawful. I don't know. But maybe it is look outward is what I'm taking from this. Look outward and think, not just inward and think. Oh, be wiser thou. Oh, be wiser you. That's you. You listening. It's talking to you. Be wise. Wise, not full of information, not full of knowledge even, full of wisdom. That's thoughtfulness. That's contemplation. That's, you know, challenging the things that you mean. You think you know what mournful means? Look it up. That's what it means to be wise. I knew what mournful meant, but I looked it up and wrote it down anyway, just so I can get all senses of it to make sure. And I didn't even think about it. Yeah. Regret and grief is, I would have thought just like sadness and, you know, that's mainly what I would have thought. It's more than just sadness. It's regret and grief and things of that nature. Who in the silent hour of inward thought can still suspect and still revere himself in lowliness of heart? Oh, be wiser thou, instructed that true knowledge leads to love, true dignity abides with him alone, who in the silent hour of inward thought can still suspect and still revere himself in lowliness of heart. What I think he's saying, or at least one aspect of what he's saying, is that if you're instructed in true knowledge, you know, that'll lead to love and love for yourself. So I think he's talking about can still suspect and still revere himself. So suspect yourself in that, you know, this is the soul body dichotomy going on, I think, or this is the two, you know, aspects of man's nature, is that there's a part of you that you should be suspicious of. And some of your motives, some of your ways of acting, you should be suspicious of. But the thing that makes you man, you should revere in yourself. Even when you're in the lowest aspect of heart, even if you're not a genius upon genius, whatever level you're at, that's what I'm taking out of it. That could be a stretch, but that's what I'm taking out of it. So And I'd love to hear what you think of this poem, what you think of the whole thing here, you know, what we're talking about with lines written upon a yew tree. At some point in the near future, I'm building up for this, so I hope you check out some of the other stuff that we do, some of the other poems that we're doing, because I'm going through several of the lyrical ballads. I'll probably take a break occasionally for you guys, but we're going through many of the lyrical ballads because I think, you know, in Troubadour, we're really trying to understand what romanticism really is. Was Rand right? What's the historical aspect? What's Rand's view of it? You know, what are other people's views of it? What are the dominant views today? Where is it right? Where is it wrong? What was Coleridge's view? I mean, there's so much to study when it comes to what it is. And the goal is, if you're not an artist, is to get just a good glimpse at great art and get exposure to great poetry and literature. That's my goal if you're not an artist. If you're an artist, I hope that you, like me, learn some of the, you know, the aspects and the ways that they used their frameworks to build great works of art. I think that's really critical, and we're kind of missing that today. We're not very thoughtful about art today. I just don't see it. I see a lot of people talking about art as though it is some kind of meaningless production. That's just entertainment for entertainment's sake, at best. When my argument is that art is more profoundly important than a brain surgeon, heart surgeon, the cancer treatment person, the cancer treatment, because it underlies all of that. It's the structure that makes all of those, or it's the fuel that makes all of those things possible. And the more and better we are at expressing and bringing out that art for all of us, the better all those other physical manifestations will be. The physical manifestations are basically fueled by the little sprinkles of great art that have kind of made their way into our culture. And that's what's sustaining what we have and kind of fueling us, puttering our little world engine along. When if we can have more art, more, you know, even understanding of the great art that we have and revive it for scientists and engineers and all the great people, then we'll explode in the future and you know, live in the kind of Jeff Bezos world where we have trillions of humans all over the solar system and all over space, which is what I, you know, advocate and I'm all about. Okay, so thank you for joining me for Sunday Morning Poetry. Go to Troubadour Mag, that's TROUBADOURMAG.com. And there's a tab for shows. You can see all the shows there. You can go to, you can listen to this on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you want. There's links up at TroubadourMag.com. And of course, you can always message me, Kirk Barbera at TroubadourMag.com. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next time.